This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.
You do meet interesting people. I've had a life of that and kept my childhood curiosity going.
This was like really seriously an 18-hour day of adventure every single day. And I got hooked, desperately hooked.
And being with the indigenous people there in the rainforest were being wiped out along with the rainforest.
That was a really big culture shock because I'd never been around white people.
I remember sitting with this guy in Vietnam talking about the war.
We meet so many interesting characters, particularly the centers.
We ran off together. No, it took us about 2 years to decide to run off together.
I learned years ago in a newspaper business, you know, centers are far more interesting than saints. There's no interest attached to a saint until they get caught.
Actually, I'm not sure about that anymore. The new breed of sinners. There are so many unimaginative, totally boring, very square sinners out there. Whole sinner franchises. Anyway, from our studio in Sebastopol, California, with giggling in the background, this is Conrad Bishop.
And Elizabeth Fuller and Hitchhiking Off the Map with stories about journeys. And oh, hey, last week, finally, our son finished a long cross-country journey in a chugging yellow Rentosaurus from Brooklyn to San Francisco. And what echoes of us close to 4 years ago, slightly bigger Rentosaurus, but chugging across here, we've made a new life, and that's what he's doing now.
Which is joyous for us, though thinking also about thousands and thousands of other sons and daughters traveling the other direction. And this is not the program for speculation on the implications of the new world order. Only to confess my own thankfulness that my son is not going there, and my guilt that other people's sons are going there, and I am paying their airfare. Mm. And if anybody's looking for a roommate in San Francisco, why, our son is very quiet and interesting and reliable.
Hey, the stories.
The stories. Which are about the news, or news as it comes out of actual people's lives and not from the media's international sausage grinder.
Two stories really nested inside each other. We're on a national email list for professional storytellers who are as diverse a group of people as there are stories to tell. And that's where we met Rocky.
What does a newspaper man do when he retires? He tells the stories he never wrote about. Rocky Rockwell lives in Bristol, Virginia, in the heart of Appalachia. He sold a string of community newspapers he managed in 1976, retired, hit golf balls for 5 years, got bored, taught journalism in college, went to a storytelling festival, thought, I can do that, and started doing it.
Oh, I've got a lot of them. I've got a collection of stories that I tell, but which I call stories that didn't make the newspaper for one reason or another. The time the cops raided the wrong loud party and things like that. big brouhaha. It was a lot of fun. I enjoyed it. But community journalism is I think it defines America, to tell you the truth. Well, good stories are character-driven. Just like, you know, a good novel. And it's the same in journalism. And every small town has a cast of interesting characters. Well, I can think of one who would be called today a homeless person, and who today would be called an addict to alcohol. Then he was a bum in the town drunk. But he was a nice fella. And, he was one of those people that all the reformers, you know, would like to save his soul from Satan and strong drink, and everybody was trying to do nice things for him over the years. And one Christmas, the Merchants Association hired him to be Santa Claus and dressed him up in a Santa Claus suit. And he had an old dog. It was named, of all things, Hangdog. And Hangdog went with him as he made his rounds on Main Street, ringing his handbell and saying, ho, 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 and while reinforced with some of his favorite 100-proof antifreeze. And Hangdog, well, he had some kind of bladder condition. He He had to stop at every post and tree, and finally came to a fire plug and lifted his leg. And well, his master did the same thing in full public view. Town cop happened to witness it and took him along, locked him up. And about a half hour later, cop was back on the street, and here comes this pair again. Somebody had obviously let him out of jail. So he goes back to the station house to see what in the world happened. He and the desk sergeant went back to the cell, and there was a great big hole in the wall. Well, what was discovered, that this character in his younger days had been the brick mason that built the jail. Anticipated that he might be in it one day, and mixed up a batch of mortar that was mostly sand, and laid up a part of the wall with that particular batch of mortar. And sure enough, when he did get in the cell, all he had to do was push against the wall, and it fell out, and he and the dog walked back out on Main Street.
We asked him to send a CD of some of his stories.
Well, which story do you plan to use on the air? Okay, well, that's a true story. It was one of those crazy things. Yeah, I'll never forget that one. And that, myself and that truck driver and going down the road at 80, 85 miles an hour chasing that truck, and whole phalanx of police cars. I had a camera balanced on top of the steering wheel. I thought I was going to get a picture of the worst truck wreck ever. It never happened. She just got down the road and pulled over to the side and went to sleep. But the odd thing was nobody ever pressed any charges.
And here's the story. Sugar Shack Salome. And then we'll continue talking with Rocky.
When the wolf kills a fawn in the woods and eats it, we say that the wolf is cruel. We tell our children and grandchildren stories about the big bad wolf. We malign the wolf because when it kills the fawn, it only means that the wolf was hungry. It does not mean that the wolf was cruel. The only cruel animal to stalk the planet Earth is mankind. It is only man who pulls the wings off flies. It's only man who makes war. And it's only man who takes delight in heaping ridicule on other people. This is a story about that. It was a cold February night. A very cold night. So cold that the snow underfoot squeaked instead of squished. And for my newspaper, I had gone down on old U.S. Route 40 between the Delaware River and Baltimore to photograph a traffic accident. Found a teenager there had wrapped a Buick around an oak tree. Took the pictures and went back to a roadside diner called the Amazing Grace Truck Stop to get a cup of coffee to thaw myself out. Grace saw me coming, had a cup of coffee ready on the counter when I walked in the place, found myself seated right next to a West Virginia truck driver who was on his way back to West Virginia after taking a load of freight up to Massachusetts. His truck was empty. The truck sat out front with its engine at idle. This was one talkative truck driver. The man was a million miler. He'd driven a million miles without an accident. And it was plain to see that he was a man who didn't make mistakes. And while I was drinking my coffee and listening to the truck driver, there was a drama going on next door to the Amazing Grace truck stop. A drama going on in a place called the Sugar Shack, which was a country roadhouse. This was a Saturday night. There was a country band over there. And in the Sugar Shack on that particular night, in the crowd, there was a lady who weighed about 400 pounds. She and her husband had gone there to celebrate a wedding anniversary. Both had had much too much to drink. The husband was comatose at the bar. The lady decided she wanted to dance. And so she went around in the crowd there at the Sugar Shack asking different men to dance with her they all refused. And she decided then to dance by herself on this little bit of a platform dance floor. And she started to dance, swayed back and forth, round and round. And she danced and danced and danced, and other people got out of the way and cleared the floor until she was there by herself. And she danced and danced and danced, and she tranced. And she became not a fat lady at the Sugar Shack. She became Salome, Salome the Temptress, in the tent of a handsome Arab sheik, a tent beneath a star-filled desert sky with a crescent moon in it. And she danced and danced and danced. And she kept on dancing until some boor in the back of the room yelled out, "Take it off! Take it off! Take it all off!" And others took up the cry, "Take it off! Take it off!" And off came the clothes, the blouse, a brassiere, a girdle that would have made 1,000 slingshots, the shoes, the stockings, everything went. And here was Salome, Sugar Shack Salome, dancing, dancing, dancing on the dance floor at the Sugar Shack. The management became alarmed. They summoned two bouncers to come and get her off the dance floor. But before that happened, there had been a song from the same boor who had started the Take It Off chant. It was that obnoxious ditty made famous by Arthur Godfrey back in the 1950s. "I don't want her, you can have her, she's too fat for me." That's when Salome began to cry. The reverie was broken. She realized that all the applause and all the laughter was not the laughter of appreciation or the applause of appreciation. It was the laughter of ridicule. And she'd burst into tears. That's when she reached to the floor, picked up a shoe, and threw it at the offending voice. Somebody caught it in midair, tossed it back on the stage. And that's when the management of the Sugar Shack summoned the bouncers. The first bouncer, big he-man, he stepped up on the stage. It was going to be easy to lead her away until he found himself absolutely flattened by an uppercut. The second bouncer backed off, and that's when Sugar Shack Salome made her way across the floor of the Sugar Shack to the ladies' room, and there she wedged herself in a toilet stall and locked the door. The second bouncer was a very, very foolish man. With a crowbar, he went in the ladies' room and he pried open the toilet stall. Sugar Shack Salome immediately grabbed the crowbar and broke his shoulder with it. He was screaming on the floor of the ladies' room, and she, with crowbar in hand, came out of the toilet stall, saw herself in the mirror, smashed the mirror with the crowbar, threw the crowbar down, went back out into the main room of the Sugar Shack, and made her way out the front door. At the front door, she was met by two state policemen, intent on quelling a disturbance. They had been summoned by the management. Like the bouncer, she flattened the first policeman right on the doorstep. The second one ran for his radio in the patrol car, while Salome, with no clothes on at all, out in that terrible cold, made her way across the parking lot and to the parking lot of the Amazing Grace truck stop. There she found out that the West Virginia trucker I was seated next to, the man who didn't make mistakes, had made one. He had left the cab door of the truck unlocked. She got in the truck. She got it into gear. And what we saw from inside the diner was the taillights of this truck starting down U.S. Route 40 toward Baltimore. The truck driver let out a scream, and we both ran out the door, he and I yelled at Grace to call the police because there'd been a truck hijacked. The trucker and I got in my car, and we took off down Route 40 behind his now stolen truck, at 80 miles an hour. I had a camera balanced on top of the steering wheel, figuring I was about to get a picture, a live-action shot, of the worst truck wreck ever. It never happened. This truck went weaving down U.S. Route 40, 70, 80 miles an hour. One by one, police patrol cars joined the chase. It was a whole phalanx of patrol cars from two states and two sheriff's departments in pursuit of this truck. There wasn't any way they could stop it. Some managed to get ahead of it as it went down the road. They blocked off intersections to keep to prevent a bad accident in case somebody got in its way. 50 miles toward Baltimore, we traveled at 70 or 80 miles an hour behind this truck. Finally, Salome got tired, pulled the truck over to the side of the road, stopped, locked the cab, lay down on the seat, and went to sleep. The trucker, well, the trucker had an extra key, unlocked the cab, and the last we saw of Sugar Shack Salome, she was being led away by five or six policemen wrapped in an army blanket to a patrol car and bawling at the top of her lungs because by now she'd started to sober up and realized what she had done. I never wrote the story. I never reported the story in any way. The reasons that I did not were several. For one thing, nobody was hurt. There was no damage. The trucker filed no complaint. His truck, after all, was 50 miles closer to home, and he wasn't about to admit that he'd made a mistake and left the cab unlocked. Interestingly, the police filed no report. The only thing that ever appeared on the police blotter was that two officers had been dispatched to quell a domestic disturbance. That report remains, I suppose, somewhere today in the state archives. I never wrote the story. I wasn't an eyewitness to what happened in the Sugar Shack. The management of the Sugar Shack never filed any complaint. They didn't want the notoriety. But like I say, I never wrote the story. And the reason I never wrote the story was this. This lady was the mother of three children in the local schools. She was not a regular at the Sugar Shack. Why cause more embarrassment by publishing a story like this? I've always been content to know ever since that for one brief moment in time, after a life of misery and torment and people staring at her because of her weight and snickers, that she had been Salome, the temptress, in an Arab's tent underneath a star-filled desert sky. And she had danced and danced and danced.
And his storytelling led to another story about himself.
Well, I owe that story to storytelling. Had it not been for us going on a storytelling cruise, I never would have pursued it.
He and his wife had gone on a storytelling cruise ship in the Caribbean, and he had to get a passport, which required a birth certificate, so he had to write back to Mississippi, where he'd been adopted. Long story short, he found the history of his birth family.
Oh, it was amazing. It was quite a shock to learn all the information that was in there and the exchange of letters that went on between my natural parents and the Mississippi Children's Home Society, which lied to them. They thought at the time they got married, they were led to believe that I'd already been adopted, when in fact I hadn't been. They were dirt poor. Had they had a lawyer, they'd have gotten me back, I'm sure.
He had been given up for adoption, and then his parents married, and he had a brother.
And I learned that his home in 1955, I guess it was, that he went looking for me, Once I learned that he had lived in Water Valley, Mississippi, I just picked up the telephone and called Mississippi Information and asked if they had a Robert H. Poteet Jr. listed, and sure enough, they did. So I called him up, got him on the phone, and asked him some questions, you know. I said, "Was your father Robert H. Poteet Sr.?" He said, "Yes." I said, "Your mother was Mary Jean Poteet?" He said, "Yes." And I said, "You're 64 years old?" He said, "Yes." I said, "Well, I got another question for you." He said, "Yes." I said, he said, "What's that?" I said, "Well, are you sitting down?" And he said, "Yes." I said, "Well, it's a good thing." I said, "Because according to Mississippi adoption records," I said, "this is your long-lost big brother calling." Well, he fell apart. Yeah, he just broke down and cried. Said he'd been looking for me for 60 years. He'd known of my existence while I had not known of his. So I was over there in 3 days. It's just a day's drive over to Water Valley. It's a little southeast of Memphis. It's about 500 miles. Well, I had mixed feelings. I didn't really know how I'd be received over there, whether I was going to be really welcomed or whether I was some kind of skeleton in the family closet. My wife, of course, was with me, and we talked about it along the way. Boy, when it comes down to counseling, I'm lucky again because I'm married to a mental health professional. I'm scared to death of the woman, actually. She has the power to have me committed, so I have to be careful. I was absolutely welcomed by everybody down there in Mississippi. They had known of my existence. And I had found out I had all these relatives over there. Gosh, all kinds of extended family. And yeah, I even found out my great-grandmother was a full-blooded Chickasaw Indian. And so when I finally met my brother, we just sat down and started talking. It's kind of funny. I grew up with the best of everything. My brother grew up going to school with cardboard in his shoes. I mean, they were poor folks. But when his parents got married, they stayed married till the day they died, became good upstanding citizens in Water Valley, Mississippi, at one point ran a cafe for a number of years. And my brother, he was in the Army in Korea, getting shot at while he was in a foxhole, and while I was fortunate going to school. So he was freight conductor on the Illinois Central Railroad for 37 years. And we don't look a bit alike. We're not look-alikes or anything like that. Although when I went over to Water Valley, some of the people over there kind of mistook me for his father. Said I favored him heavily. And I'm so glad that I didn't learn any of this story until the old folks of both families were dead and gone. I don't know what kind of emotional stress there would have been had both families been alive. I had such really wonderful adoptive parents, and I do identify with them, absolutely. I was very lucky. Out of that whole adoption, I got the best end of the deal. Well, I live in the middle of 84 acres of woods here in the mountains of Appalachia, and I enjoy talking with the neighbors and listening to... I love language, always have, and the language here and the native language is just absolute music. You hear things that you don't hear anywhere else in the country. That's one of the great things about storytelling, is that we tend to preserve so many of the different dialects and idiomatic expressions and different accents that exist in the American language. And it's particularly nice here. I'll stay with the storytelling thing. I'll just keep on telling stories. I enjoy it. I don't do too much. I don't want to make a full-time career out of it. I don't need any more full-time careers. I'm 72 years old. I can't make too many plans. Things speed up and then you blow a fuse and the lights go out. So it goes.
By phone from Bristol, Virginia, we were talking with Reginald Rocky Rockwell. The strings were the VW Boys. Rocky's email address is timberrock@aol.com.
So that's our trips for this week. Hitchhiking Off the Map is produced by The Independent Eye, with funding from the National Endowment for the Arts and the California Arts Council.
Thank you. And from the Hitchhikers Guild, which you can join by visiting our website, www.independenteye.org. And send us your comments and your email address. We send out monthly updates on the shows and also when we're performing live in the area.
And you'll find our CDs there. Oh, hey, we just got a lovely review of our Nativity CD in the Complete Mother magazine, demanding that libraries buy it so that, quote, your entire community can listen and be filled with wonder, close quote. Wow.
I so much want an entire community that's filled with wonder.
Next up, a Mississippi girl looks into the face of the murdered Emmett Till. Years later, she's homesteading in Australia, a glimpse of two worlds.
This is Conrad Bishop.
And Elizabeth Fuller, wishing to our sons and daughters and their friends and their roommates and their grandchildren and even phone solicitors, peace and joy.
You ever hear of Barter Theater? Yeah, I was director of storytelling there for 3 years, yeah. It's right up the road from where I live. We had Gregory Peck out here last year. Yeah, he's 86 years old or something like that. He did a one-man show as a fundraiser for Barter. That's where he got his start. And it was all over with. He came through the offices shaking hands with some of the staff. And the little old secretary there, about 18 years old, after he left, she said, "Who is he?" How soon they forget.